Svanitam Gaganasadrisham Tatvamasyadilakshyam Eyakam Nityam Vimalachalam Sarvati Sakshibhutam Bhavadinam Prigunaraitam Satguru Tam Namami Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Okay. In the introduction to the 13th chapter, you have this in your handout. There's an introduction before he begins his commentary. It's a little challenging if you haven't read the previous chapters. It's hard to know what he's talking about here. He says, I'll read, you can read with me. Did you get one of those handouts?
If you have one.
Yeah, yeah, we do have.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
He says in chapter 7, two prakritis, the word prakriti in Sanskrit means nature, two natures of God. Ishvara has been mentioned. He has two prakritis, two natures. The first nature is called apara, inferior nature. The first, an inferior nature, and it consists of the three gunas. Everybody knows what the three gunas are: sattva, rajas, and tamas. That's his lower nature. And those three gunas, they modify themselves into eight modifications that's mentioned in the seventh chapter. And those are earth, water, fire, air, and space. The five elements: manas, buddhi, and ahamkara. The mind, the intellect, and the I sense. They're nothing but modifications of the three gunas. Even that ego is nothing but made up of the three gunas. And that's called his lower nature. An inferior one, consisting of the three constituents, and it's eightfold. The eightfold is what I just mentioned: five elements, mind, intellect, and ego. It is the cause of empirical life. Without the three gunas, there's no empirical life. Everything is made up of the three gunas. Let me just say something about this. In modern day, if we go to school and we try to learn out what is this world made of, they don't say it's made of the three gunas. They tell us it's made up by, I don't know how many elements we have now, it's 108, the periodic table, they list 108 elements, and that's what the world is made up of. In those days, they didn't, of course, have that understanding of nature, so they just divided it up into three basic categories, and they explained things in those terms. And it was sufficient for their purposes, and it's sufficient for our purposes also, because it just means matter. You can divide it up any way you want. It doesn't really change what's being taught here. So what it really means is this whole universe, which is made up of earth and wind, fire and air and space, water, this whole universe is what's called the apara prakriti, the lower nature of God. It's because it comes and goes, it appears and disappears. This is in the, by the way, if you study the seventh chapter, this becomes clear. The second nature of God, that's the lower nature, the second nature is a superior one. And he's called Jiva Bhutaha, the living being. And that Jiva Bhuta is the Kshetranya. That witness in you is the higher nature. These are the two natures of God. His higher nature is the witness in you, and the lower nature is the three gunas and their modifications. It is by means of these two natures, the witnessing consciousness and nature, these two natures, that God is said to be the cause of the origin, sustenance, and dissolution of the world. Everything comes from that, everything abides in that, and everything dissolves in that. Without the gunas, God cannot be the creator of the world. He needs these gunas. By the way, the gunas in Vedanta are also called Maya. They're not really existing. Prakriti is Maya in Vedanta. So with God's Maya, he creates the world. But since Maya is that which never was, is, or will be, God never created the world. But if you think there's a world, then it came from God, it abides in God, and it resides in God. He is Brahma, he is Vishnu, he is Maheshwara. This present chapter, the 13th chapter, on the field, this chapter is called actually the Yoga of the Field and the Field Knower, but it describes mostly about what is the field. So this chapter on the field is begun to determine the truth about God. What is his real nature? By means of a study of these two powers. His lower power, the three gunas, and his higher power, the witnessing consciousness that's in everyone, which is the same as God. Almost. I'll explain that when we come to it later. The field and the field knower. That's called the Kshetra, the field, and the field knower. The Kshetra Gya. Gya means knower in Sanskrit. Kshetra Gya and the Kshetra. These are the two things that are going to be discussed here. These two, the field and the field knower, these two powers, since God is the owner of these two powers, Maya is not independent of God, like in Samkhya. In Samkhya philosophy, Prakriti is separate and God is separate from Prakriti. It's a dualistic philosophy. But here, Maya has no independent existence apart from God. Just like the snake has no independent existence apart from the rope. It's not a separate thing. This world is not really different than God, who God really is. But because of our ignorance, we see it as the world. If we knew the truth of it, we'd see it as God. So then he says, in chapter 12, that's the preceding chapter before this one, in chapter 12, the immediately preceding chapter, in verses 13 through 20, was set forth the discipline, that's a bad word. The word in Sanskrit is nishta. It's better translated as the devotion. The devotion of the renouncers, of those who've renounced all interest in anything else but God. They've become consumed with God. They've renounced all other pursuits. Those are called sannyasis. Nyasa means to abandon. San means completely. Sannyasa is to completely abandon all of the not-self. Everything that's not you is nyasa, thrown away. Sam, completely. That's who a sannyasi is. I once asked my teacher, Swamiji, when did you take sannyasa? He says, you don't take sannyasa. Sannyasa is when you've given up everything. You don't take sannyasa. It's not something you take. When you've renounced everything other than self, that's called sannyasa. Just a side note. So, in chapter 12, those renunciers who know the truth, you can't give up everything, including your ego, unless you know the truth of the witness. You can't really be a sannyasi unless you've understood the truth of your own self. If you go live in a cave, you're not a sannyasi, because you're going to still have wood. You're going to still need some food in that cave. You can't renounce everything until you know the truth. So, in those verses, 13 through 20, was set forth the discipline of the renouncers who know the truth. Of what kind is the knowledge of that truth, whose possession, together with the practice of the characteristics mentioned, makes one dear to the Lord? Who is dear to Paramatma? As long as I take myself to be this body, mind, senses, and ego, then I'm an individual, and the Lord is different from me, because I have little power, he's Sarva Shaktiman, all-powerful. I have very little knowledge, he's Sarvajna, all-knowing. And I am sitting on a chair here, but the Lord is Sarvavyapi Vishnu. The Lord pervades everywhere. He's omnipresent. So I'm different from the Lord. And in that relationship, I have to become the Lord's bhakta. I have to fall in love with that supreme being from that point of view. This is where bhakti comes in. I think I mentioned yesterday that in the seventh chapter, he mentions four types of devotees. And the highest devotee is the wise man, because he has become one with the self. But all the other devotees, they feel that they're different from the Lord. All of us ignorant people that identify with our bodies, the Lord is the supreme being, and I'm not the supreme being. And I have to turn my mind to that supreme being and get myself devoted to him, thinking about him, wanting to merge into him. Once again, I'm using the word him, but please, he has no sex. Neuter. Brahman is a neuter noun. It's not male or female. So, but just in parlance, we should call him him. So, these verses, 13 through 20, are the verses that describe who a bhakta, who is a real devotee, that real renouncer, that true person who has turned his mind to God exclusively, and what are his characteristics. And when you get those characteristics, what is God's attitude towards you? So I'm just going to, you don't have this in your book, I'm going to turn to chapter 7, and I just want to read these verses to you to give you an idea of what is bhakti according to the Bhagavad Gita. The whole book is bhakti. It starts off with the whatever you do, whatever you say, whatever you practice, do that as an offering to me, Arjuna. You will attain perfection in this way. In the karma yoga, whatever karma you perform, whatever duty you undertake, do that as an offering to me. Turn your mind to me. Join all of your actions to me. Make your actions an offering to me. Forget about the fruit of your actions, Arjuna. That will bind you. Lose all interest in the fruits of your actions and do them with an attitude, I'm doing everything for that, and he will give me the fruit of the action. And whatever that fruit is, I'm going to take the fruit of my actions like prasada. You know, at the end of the arti, they come and they go like this. So you're supposed to put out your hand. It's nice if you bend your head a little in humility, and they drop that prasada because it's been offered. It's been offered to the Supreme. So once it's offered, now it's called prasada. And then you take it with an attitude of humility and acceptance. If anybody in the hall there, when they come with the prasada, they put something in your hand, you go, oh, you got anything else over there? Then it's not prasada. Whatever it is, it's prasad, away. I once went to Tiruvannamalai, and I don't know if everybody knows about this place. It's in South India. It's where Ramana Maharshi had his set up there. And there's a famous mountain. It's called Arunachala. And so somebody told me there was a very great tapasvi ascetic who was living on the top of the mountain. His name was Narayana Guru. And he lives on one glass of goat milk a day, and he's been living up there for 12 years. And if you want, you can go up there and have darshan every day at 5 o'clock. Narayana Guru gives darshan. I said, that sounds interesting. I'd like to check this guy out. So I climbed up to the top of the mountain. It's about 4:30. And he's got these young boys, his chelas, and they kind of set up the thing. You don't see Narayana Guru immediately. And they tell you, so there were four of us up there. Me, my son, and two Indian pilgrims. Somehow we met on the way up. Where are you going? Oh, we're going to go have darshan with Narayana Guru. So we all go up, and the disciples say, okay, line up. First, we're going to give out prasad. Okay. So we line up, and they give us these coconut things, and they come, and they put in the coconut something. And I look, and it's rock, what do they call it? Rock sugar.
Molasses.
Molasses?
No.
So it's kind of like a rock sugar. And I look at it, and there's all larvae, white little worms crawling all over the sugar. And now I'm thinking, prasad? So I said, no, I can't do it. So I say, my son's in back of me, he's got the same thing. I said, Devin, don't take the prasad. He goes, sorry, Dad, too late. But in general, whatever they put in your hand, you take that thing.
Did he get help?
There was no problem. I guess it was prasad. But anyway, the attitude is whatever it is. So the fruits of my actions are the prasad of Paramatma, and whatever happens, he'll provide for it. I have no interest in that. I'm doing all of my activities with my mind joined to him. That karma becomes karma yoga. That's the meaning of the beginning of karma yoga. When I've lost the interest in the results of my actions, and I'm doing it as an offering to him, to that, and whatever the result of that action is, I take that as it's all coming from him. He knows what's best for me. That fruit, even though it seems like it's not what I wanted, somehow it must be to my advantage, or else Paramatma wouldn't have provided that fruit. So whatever it is, good or bad, I take it in a spirit of it's coming from him, and I've done it as an offering to him, and I'm not concerned about the thing, and you get the prasada. You can see there's bhakti involved even in that beginning karma yoga. The very beginning of the sadhana of the Bhagavad Gita is karma yoga. The first stages. Karma yoga has 5 stages. People think that's the whole of karma yoga, but in fact, that's the kindergarten program. There's a lot more to it. Well, that's not the subject matter here. So, in the 7th chapter, let me turn to it now. In the 12th chapter, thank you. In the 12th chapter, by the way, do you see what I'm doing here? I'm licking my tongue, and when I used to sit with my teacher and we'd study the Gita, occasionally I'd go like that, and he would scream at me, "What are you, spitting on the Gita?" He would never allow me to do that. That's the thing, you can't put the Gita on the floor, you can't spit on the Gita. But of course, it's what you're dealing with here. So, in the 12th chapter, just before the 13th shloka, there's this little portion starting, I would say, innate. I'll just briefly read this to you. He tells Arjuna, "Fix your mind on me alone. Let your intellect be absorbed in me. If you do this, henceforth, in me alone, you will dwell." Having your mind totally established in that truth of Paramatma, if you can do that, you will certainly come to me. Then in the 9th shloka, he says, "If you are unable to do this, to have your mind steadily on me, if you can't do that," and there's nobody in this room, I'm quite confident, that can do that, "seek to reach out to me through the yoga of repeated effort." It's called Abhyasa Yoga. "You may not be able to always keep your mind on Paramatma, but if you're unable to, then at least try again and again and again to bring the mind back whenever it goes out, to grab it and once again bring it back and concentrate it on that Supreme Being." That's called Abhyasa Yoga. If you can't steadily have your mind on me, then at least try to practice it over and over, Abhyasa Yoga. Then in the next shloka he says, "And if you can't make even those repeated efforts of Abhyasa Yoga, then," he says, devote yourself wholly to my works. Okay, you can't have your mind always on me. Then do all of your actions as an offering to me. And here, the way to really offer all of your actions to Paramatma, which is the third lowest rung of the ladder here, is to do it with the feeling that it's not only that I don't want the fruit of the action, I'm not attached to the action, and I'm not even attached to the desire that came up in my mind to do the action. In Sanskrit, that's called sankalpa. First we think, hey, I'm going to go do that. Then we do it, and then we get the fruit of that action. But here, if you can't constantly have your mind on me, then do all of your actions with no attachment to the action, the fruit of the action, or even the desire that will arise that prompts you to do the action. No attachment to any of that. It's the third rung of the ladder. Devote yourself wholly to doing my works with no attachment. Even by doing works for my sake with no attachment to those works, including, it's not just the attachment to the fruit, but to the very karma itself. That's different. If you can't do that, then even doing works for my sake, if you can do that, you also will achieve perfection. Each one of these sadhanas leads to perfection, but not directly. It was only that first one. When you have your mind on me alone, when your buddhi is absorbed in me alone, then you will dwell in me alone. But if you can't do that, then do this. Practice that over and over. If you can't do that, then at least do all of your works with no attachment to those works as an offering to me. And then in 11 he says, now, in 11, if resorting to union with me, you want to become one with that Supreme Being, if in resorting to reunion with me, you are unable to even do this, do your works as an offering to me with no attachment to the works, to the desire to do the work or the fruit, then, with self-control, try to renounce at least your desire for the fruits of your works. Karma pala tyaga, to abandon the pala, the fruit of your works, the lowest rung of the ladder of spiritual sadhana is not being attached to the fruit of your works. It's 50 years since I've been studying this. I can't get on this first rung of the program yet. Even this lowest rung of karma yoga, not being attached to the fruit of your works, is already very difficult. You try it, and you'll come to understand. If you try it sincerely, you'll come to understand that it's quite a challenge, even that lowest rung of the ladder of sadhana. So, after enumerating all of these, because in the beginning of this chapter, in order to understand this, you kind of have to go back. It starts with a question. Arjuna says to Krishna, of your devotees, which one is better? Those who worship you elaborately in many forms through their works, through their karma, worshiping you by going to the temple and worshiping you by doing his japa and worship you by doing service to other people. Those of you who worship you elaborately, and those who worship the unmanifest, the imperishable. Amongst these two types of devotees, who is the best of the yogis? That's how it begins. So he says that the best of the yogis is not the one who fixes his mind on the absolute reality, because it's too difficult. You won't be able to do it, and you'll become a phony and a fraud. So Krishna doesn't say that right from the get-go, right from the beginning, we should try this higher sadhana. He says, setting their minds on me, ever integrated, those who worship me through their works with absolute faith, I will attain this. I will come to know who you are, Paramatma. I deem the best of the yogis. But those who worship the imperishable, that witnessing consciousness in everyone, the Supreme Lord, the ineffable, the unmanifest, the omnipresent, the imponderable, because you can't even think of it, the immutable, because it never changes in time or space, the immobile, unchanging, the unwavering, those who worship that. But those who do that, controlling all of the senses so they're not running here and there, fully, with the cognition of sameness at all times, they see God everywhere, at all times. All this universe for them has become Paramatma. And they are devoted to the welfare of all beings. They have no selfish motives left for themselves. If they spend their time doing anything, it's only for the benefit of others, because they have no benefit. They don't need any benefit for themselves. But their toil is harder, their minds being set on the unmanifest imperishable. For an embodied being, O Arjuna, it is very hard to tread the path of the unmanifest. What does that mean? As long as you're identified with this body, that's called an embodied being, this path of realizing the self that has no body is very difficult. And therefore, Krishna does not recommend that path to Arjuna, and over the shoulder of Arjuna to us, not recommended. You don't begin there. So for those who are not qualified for that, he says, those, however, who surrender all of their karma to me, making me as their supreme goal, and they worship me, meditating on me in a state of undivided union, it's a bad translation, ananya yogena, in unswerving yoga, not undivided union, that's a different object. For them who have set their thoughts on me, I will soon deliver them out of this ocean of samsara. Fix your mind on me alone. While doing all of your actions, have your mind on me. Let your understanding be absorbed in me while you're doing all of your activities. And henceforth, doubtless, you will eventually come to dwell in me. Then in 9 he begins, if you can't concentrate your mind on me steadfastly, then you do this repeated abhyasa again and again. If you can't do that, then do all of your works for me with no attachment to those works. And if you can't do that, then at least give up your attachment to the fruit of the work. In other words, I do the work, but let Paramatma give the fruit. I do the work, but God will give the fruit. The stage before that is, I don't do the work. It's all going on, but I have no attachment to any of it. It's very difficult. That's called Naishkarma Siddhi. While the actions are going on, you feel I do nothing. But if you can't do that, then do the work with the feeling that I'm doing my duty, whatever my duty is, but I'm not attached to the fruit. I'm taking the fruit as prasada. So after having done that, he now talks about the second type of devotee, those who do know the truth, who worship the unmanifest, the imperishable, the akshara. Kshara means that which gets destroyed. Akshara is the indestructible. Those people who worship the akshara. And it begins in 13. These are the real bhaktas in the true sense of the term. And so by understanding these qualities, we can see where our minds are at. They're not up to this level, but at least we have an idea of what the goal might look like if you really want to be a bhakta. And here it begins. I'm just going to read it and see. Advaishta Sarva Bhutanam. He hates no beings. He hates no beings. Even Donald Trump. He is friendly and compassionate. Compassion, feeling that another one's pain is your pain. Empathy, seeing everyone as their own self and therefore feeling compassion. The compassion in Vedanta stems from the fact that the wise man sees everybody as his own self. That's the basis for compassion. If you see someone as different from you, that person could be an enemy to you. But if you see them as your own self, you must feel compassion for them. You must love them, because everybody loves their own self. Free from the feeling of possession and egotism. This is mine, my house, my money, my children, my... Everything belongs to you, Paramatma. Whatever you've given to me, it's on loan from you. It's going to go back to you. I really own nothing. Nirmamo nirahamkara. This bhakta can't be filled with ahamkara, that egotism, that I'm a big, oh, I'm a bhakta. Oh, there's no bhakta like me. Sama Dukkha Sukha Kshami. He is the same in Sukha. When happiness comes, the bhakta doesn't become extremely elated. When difficulties arise, the bhakta doesn't become extremely upset. Kshami, he puts up with what is happening.
That was that titiksha quality.
Putting up with the unavoidable bad things that happen in our lives. That feeling of endurance, enduring. Santushta, content, satisfied, happy. Satatam, always. Whether good or bad, heat or cold, victory or defeat. He's satata tushtaha. That bhakta has now gotten to the stage where nothing can break his contentment. That yogi, he's become a yogi because now he's joined his mind and become one with that supreme reality. That's the true yogi. That's the meaning of what a yogi is. He's controlled himself and he has dritta nishchaya, a firm resolve that this is my path. Mayi arpita mano buddhihi. He's offered to me his whole mind and his whole intellect has been offered up to that Supreme Being. He who is like this, yo, mat bhakta, my bhakta, the one who's devoted to me, sa me priyaha, he is very dear to me. That bhakta is dear to the Supreme Lord. From him the world does not shrink, nor does he shrink from the world. Bad translation. From whom the world is not bothered. He doesn't make problems in the world. And for him, the world is not a problem. That's the attitude. He's not looking to make problems in the world. And he doesn't see the world as a problem to him. He is free from elation, intolerance, fear and agitation. Sacha me priyaha. He is dear to me. That bhakta becomes dear to me when he's like this. Anapekshaha. He doesn't depend on anything except the Lord. The Lord will provide for whatever is necessary. Anapekshaha. He doesn't depend on anything outside of his own self. When I say the Lord, you can easily take that word to mean your own self. There's no difference in the Bhagavad Gita. Anapekshaha, suchi, he's pure in his mind and his body. Daksha, he's skillful in his actions because none of those actions bind him like they do the ignorant person. Everybody is doing their actions to get the fruit. And when that fruit comes, they're elated. That's a bondage. When the fruit doesn't come, they're dejected. That's a bondage. But this yogi, whether the good comes or the bad comes, he's unaffected. It's coming from him, it's his prasada. There must be some benefit in it. That's skill in action. There's a definition in the Gita that says, Kaushalam. Who said that?
Kaushalam.
Listen to this. Karma Kaushalam Karma Su. Yoga is skill in action. Yeah? Daksha, he's skilled in his action. He's learned how to do the actions so they no longer bite him. They can no longer affect him in the way that it affects other people. That's called daksha. Mat bhakta same priyaha. The one who has these qualities, this is a bhakta. This is what it's not just some silly emotion. Oh, I love God. Let's go have dinner. It's a whole way of life and whole attitude of the mind. And if you hear these qualities, you see how far you are away from what it means to be a bhakta. It's an exalted state, this bhakti. It's not going to kirtan and singing Hare Rama, Hare Krishna for an hour. I guarantee that's part of it. That can be part of it. Kirtan is a wonderful thing. But it's merely just one little aspect of the life of a bhakta. Let me say one thing about kirtan, because everybody likes kirtan. It makes us feel good. But if you take the kirtan in this way, the one who's leading the kirtan, when he goes, or she goes, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. You see that arising out of that Paramatma. And it's coming into your ears, and it enters into Paramatma in the form of you. And then that same out of you, that Paramatma, you repeat, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And it's going back to the leader of the kirtan. Back and forth, but the whole thing is happening in Paramatma. It's coming out of Paramatma. It's merging into Paramatma in me. It comes out of myself. Hare Rama, because everything comes out of myself. When that kirtanaya sings, it's coming out of that same self. So the kirtan arises in God. It's abiding in God. It merges in God. It comes out of God. It abides in God. The whole kirtan is in God. Then you've spiritualized the kirtan in a very beautiful way. The kirtan becomes really spiritual if you can understand that that's the truth of the matter. He is happy without break. In the commentary, Shankara says he's happy without break always, both when he gains and when he fails to gain, even the sustenance for the maintenance of his body. I don't know if you know this, but in the ancient days when you became a sannyasi, you were supposed to wander off barefoot, no possessions, and you wander around, and you go to the edge of the village as you're wandering. And when you come to the edge of the village, you're supposed to three times, you go, Om Namo Narayana. Om Namo Narayana. Om Namo Narayana. And then you wait. Someone in the village, a Brahmana woman, hopefully, has prepared food. And she comes to the edge of the village, and you either have your begging bowl, and if you don't, if you're a real sannyasi, you just got your hand. And they drop some food into the hand. And you don't say, oh, you got anything else? That's not really my take. Whatever's dropped in the hand, you eat off and you go. If there's people in the village that are interested in spirituality, you can sit under a tree for up to 3 days and the people can come and you can teach them about bhakti and karma and the basic things about Vedanta. After 3 days, you have to leave. or else you're going to get attached to that village. If you go Om Namo Narayana 3 times and no food comes, thank you, Lord. You must know I need a fast now. I'm heading out. And you go just the same. Whether you get what you were begging for or you don't get, that's what the sannyasi's attitude was supposed to be. He's happy with anything, santushtaha, whether he gets even the sustenance for his own body. He is happy with that break, integrated, yuktaha. That means he's joined to that. His mind is joined to that. He's self-disciplined. That's yata atma. He's controlled himself. Yata atma. Dhriti nishchaya. Firm conviction. He's offered his intellect to me. From him the world does not shriek. He does not bother the world doesn't bother him. He is dear to me who craves not, who is pure and skillful, who is udasi. In the text, udasi. Ever hear of an udasi? There's a group of monks in India, they're called udasins. The word means indifferent. I mean, in English, they translate it as indifferent. There's a group of monks that are indifferent. I've joined the indifferent group. I'm hanging out with them. They're totally indifferent. I love it. And the idea is they have no interest. They're indifferent to whatever happens. These guys wear all black. They're not like sannyasis that wear orange. And they run around India and they're called udasis. But the word udasi doesn't mean indifferent. Because suppose I'm walking down the street and I see an old lady there and she has her hand out and looks up and says, food, food. I'm indifferent. And you keep walking. That indifference, how could that be for a sannyasi to be indifferent like that? If he sees her, if he has anything, he'll give it to her. It doesn't mean indifferent like that. It's kind of like, you know, I have long hair and a beard. I don't look like everybody else, so I kind of get a lot of attention, especially in really straight places. So I was on the beach once in Hawaii, and I was walking down the beach, and I had the long hair and the beard, and I'm walking, and I realize all the people, they're all staring at me. I'm like a show as I'm walking down the street. And I become self-conscious about it. And I see one mother had a child, and as I'm approaching, she grabbed the kid, you know, just in case. Who knows who this guy is. He might be drug-crazed person or something. Grabbed the kid. And I realized, boy, I'm really not indifferent to how these people are paying attention to me. It's really bothering me. In fact, well, it doesn't matter, but class is over. Where am I? Let me just see. Forget that story. Udasi means not indifferent. The word udasi. Anyone knows asana? Seated. A seat. Seated. Ud. Ud in Sanskrit means above. Seated above is udasi. When you're not even aware that there's people on the beach and you're walking, that's called udasi. Because I learned a trick. If I'm thinking about those people, then I'm concerned about what they're thinking. But if I'm walking on the beach and I'm singing Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama, they're gone. I'm udasi. That's udasi. Not even knowing that they're there is an udasana. It's not just indifferent. That makes no sense. It's when you don't even know that they're there. That's called udasi. The only way to get to that stage is to have your mind buried in God. I'm going to end it now. It's 10. It's 9 o'clock, and we'll continue it this afternoon. Let's do the Purnamada. Before I say it, that absolute reality is fullness. Because of ignorance, this seems like fullness. From that real fullness, this fullness has come. But because this fullness is just Maya, when you take it away, fullness alone remains. Om.